of the crop.
Welcome to the 163rd edition of the Gooner Podcast. This is your host, Kevin Witcher, and we are recording this on the Tuesday evening before Arsenal face Ostersunds at home in the Europa League. This is on Thursday evening that's happening, before travelling to Wembley for the Carabao Cup final on Sunday. I will keep the panel intros brief once again, as I've run out of things to say about two of them, and I can't find any dirt on the third. First up, the media face and voice of the Gooner, drinking sparkling water. It's a very good evening to Mr. David Udo.
Evening all.
Second up, a welcome return from foreign parts to a media mogul and a voice for truth and justice. As the next issue of the Hampstead Village Voice will confirm, it's the man of many names, many faces and many voices drinking Britvic 55. It's hello to Mr. Mustafa Goldstein.
Thank you. Hello.
And our special guest this month, appearing for the first time since his podcast debut 2 years ago in February 2016, a regular and reasoned contributor to the Gooner, so God alone knows what he's doing in the present company, drinking Diet Coke, it's a warm welcome back to Mr. Bernard Dowling.
Hello, everyone.
Right, gentlemen. So, plenty to discuss, but I will just run through what's happened since we last recorded our podcast 5 weeks ago. A couple of home wins to start with against Palace, and then in the League Cup, Chelsea, which saw us qualify for the final. A disastrous visit to Swansea, where we lost 3-1. But it was all good again when we faced Everton at home and the return of Theo Walcott for a 5-1 Arsenal victory. And then the Wembley trip. The one on Sunday will be better than this. It was a defeat in the North London Derby. And then we rounded off with a visit to Sweden, in which a penalty was saved and the Gunners won 3-0. In that time, we've had 2 weekends off for the FA Cup, where obviously we're no longer involved. I'm going to start with a contribution from one of our Twitter followers, and it's an interesting idea. And he writes, this is Andrew Kingerby, actually it's via email, to be correct. If social media and Arsenal Fan TV had been around in 1989, Do you still think we'd have won at Anfield? I suspect the players would have been subjected to torrents of abuse and their characters called into question for letting our lead slip at the top of the table, and history might have turned out differently. So, do we think that in the first instance, the players today really take any notice of what fans are saying on social media? And the second one, do you think the Arsenal fan base would have been so down on the players in 1989?
Oh, crikey, where to start? With regards to the former, I think Hector Bellerin showed when he was talking at the Oxford Union, I think it was, last week, when he was asked a question directly about Arsenal Fan TV and said, it brings people down. And you kind of don't blame them. I mean, if someone said to me that my days at work and, you know, nature of any office is such that there are levels of internal politics that are a sitcom in their own right. I mean, if I could find the worldwide audience of tens of millions have their opinion on what goes on in this department with this people, I mean, Christ, I'd want to see it every single day and know, how I come across, how I'm portrayed, how my performances are analysed, absolutely. With regards to the 89 team, I don't think Arsenal Fan TV would be as harsh towards those players as they are now, because we have week after week of sheer disappointment, whereby, you know, we should be delivering far more than we do. As was sort of relayed to me during the Q&A I went to ahead of the premiere of 89 at the end of last year, was when we did go 2-2 at home to at home to Wimbledon, last home game of the season. It wasn't a boo all the way around. It was a nice round of applause in the sense, oh, bless them, you know, they gave them their best. But, of course, at that point, we're a team that finished between 4th and 8th every year, rather than challenging for the title. So, it was more supportive, whereas we are now the most expensive ticket and everything, and not delivering what we're doing, and the abuse is deserved.
What have they put in that Highland Spring you're drinking, David?
that was an impressive monologue.
Thank you very much. I'll do it in an Alan Bennett accent next time. Yeah.
Bernard,
yeah,
do you remember that period?
Yes,
in
I do.
The spring of 80s.
Yeah, I do. And I... Firstly, I don't think the players would have been criticised to the level that they are now. But every player has his own personality. I'm not sure players back then would have been bothered by criticism as presumably Bellerin is these days. Having said that, I suspect Bellerin's a bit unusual because players these days are so stinking rich. You know, why listen to the fans all that much? You know, sure, they like to receive praise rather than criticism, but I'm not convinced that all that many players take any notice of things like Arsenal Fan TV or whatever it's called. Myself, I hardly ever watch it or have seen it.
In fairness to Bellerin, the impression I got was that although he was aware of it,
yeah,
his basic message was... It doesn't bother the players.
No, I really don't think it would. No.
I don't think it does. I think it's funny Bellerin's the player mentioned here because he's a sort of bête noir of mine at the moment, and I actually blocked him on Twitter. I was so
hey, Basting, what did you do to
you? No, just looking at him doing these poses he does. Look at me in the sun, and look at me, all this sort of like, you know, sort of modelling and stuff. And I was like, oh, just sod off. And I was just watching him. Gone off him as a player quite a while ago. He's, you know, look, there's always one, isn't there? And for me, Bellerin is, you know, every time he gets the ball, it's, oh God, you're just going to run down the right and kick it against their defender, aren't you? That's what you're going to do, isn't it?
If you're talking about players posing, all right, and acting up, for want of a better phrase,
yeah,
how would you compare Bellerin with Charlie George?
Well, but yes, okay, fair enough. Well, look, you've always had those players. You've always had I suppose, well, Charlie George just drank more, probably, I should imagine. In the 70s, everyone drank a lot of alcohol, didn't they?
But he did a lot of what we would call over-the-top things.
The celebration at Wembley in 71.
Yeah, and just dressing up like a complete buffoon on many occasions.
It was a bit more, I don't know. Look, I was a kid then, so I'd have looked through it through different eyes. Now I'm looking at, you know, I suppose there isn't probably much difference. By the way, we do like it when I bump into Arsenal players.
We do.
And 3 days ago, so this kind of correlates with this question, I bumped into none other than the BFG himself.
Oh.
Outside Gales.
So two BFGs meet.
You could say that, yes. Well, I met him before, and he's one of those players. You've got Ian Wright and Lee Dixon on one side, who you meet, and they're like, talk to you all afternoon, right? And you've got people like, I'd say, the BFG and Overmars on the others, who will go, what do you want? I'm getting out of here, right?
Really?
Yeah, and the BFG, he was with a couple of friends, a couple of German mates, and so I said to him in German, I said, oh, first of all, I said, hello, Pierre, and he went, oh, hello, and he was all smiling. I said, was this Law Smith Arsenal, right? Which means, what's going on with Arsenal at the moment, right? And he was like, oh, I said, first I said, let's hope things get a bit better for the Gunners, right? Mm-hmm. And he said, yes, every day it gets better, like that. I was like, right, okay. And then I said, what's going on with Arsenal? And he just sort of walked off. Sort of thought, okay, I don't like this bloke. I can say I don't get on that well with the BFG. Although he's still, for that FA Cup final against Chelsea, one of my footballing heroes of all time, just for that. But I think, you know, look, he's not like one of these people who's comfortable, you know. I think there are people who are like, they're Arsenal men, right? Like, I don't know, George Graham, Bob Wilson. Like, if you bumped into Bob Wilson and asked him a question about Arsenal, he'd stop and talk to you and know straight away you're an Arsenal fan. And, you know, you're like what I would call Arsenal men talking Arsenal, right? And then there are other people who are like these superstars who are like, oh, you're just a fan and I'm a superstar, right? And there's a different mentality there.
Mm. I must admit, I think Mertesacker is an Arsenal man. You know, I think you've got to understand, he probably felt uncomfortable.
Yeah.
You know, he can't slag off Wenger or anyone.
No, I understand that totally. Yeah, no, I mean, in that context, listen, he's Arsenal captain as well, and he's some bloke he doesn't know comes up to him in the street. Why should he give me the time of day?
Exactly.
I mean, he'll give me the time of day, but why should he give me any more? And to be fair to Mertesacker, he's great with the fans on the pitch, and he comes up. No, I think, look, I'm not knocking Mertesacker at all. I mean, and you know, listen, he's got a life. Why does he have to stop and talk to me? I mean, that's, you know, I understand that totally. I just get the vibe. He's not a sort of like locally kind of guy, you know, who you stop and chat with. Some people are. George Graham, George Graham took me for a coffee once. I mean, you know.
But all these people that will spend time for you have effectively retired. Would that be true?
Yeah, that's probably it as well. Yeah. They drop a shoulder once they're retired. That's probably a very good point, yeah. I mean, whilst they're still playing. And even, funnily enough, someone like Freddie Ljungberg, who I bumped into in the high street recently, and took a photo for the Hampstead Village Voice. And
when is that
available? It just happens to be on Friday the 5th of March, which is my birthday. So if you want to buy me a birthday present, go and buy the magazine. And now he's semi-retired. I mean, he's still with Wolfsburg, isn't he, as a sort of in a coaching capacity.
He got sacked.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, well, the manager got sacked and Freddie went with him.
Oh, right, okay. So, but anyway, he's still kind of, he's in the game, so to speak. He seemed much more relaxed and kind of than when he was living and playing, when he was living in Hampstead and playing for Arsenal and winning things and actually being a player, he was there was a different vibe. It's funny, they do. They just relax once they're retired.
Exactly.
Okay.
Fair enough.
Andrew Kingerby followed up, and so I'll read out what he put and then we'll discuss. When you actually watch and listen to what Hector Bellerin said at the Oxford Union, what did he do wrong? Many fans are embarrassed by those shrieking idiots on Arsenal Fan TV who are just a bunch of self-absorbed reality TV stars, in quotes, trying to build their brand by criticising the team they claim to love. In fairness to Arsenal Fan TV, I think what happens is that the more popular regulars are those that are critical, but the channel certainly tries to canvass all spectrum of opinion and will give anyone time to have their say, which is echoes the Gooner in that respect. We are an open church which will always present both sides of an argument. It's just that in recent seasons there haven't been many people coming forward for the positive side of the argument where the club's concerned, and we cannot control that. We can only open our doors and say, here we are. However, let's discuss. I mean, Arsenal Fan TV is a phenomenon of its own. I mean, Bernard, you're of a generation that perhaps they're not aimed at so much. Have you watched it?
I have seen it, but not all that often.
Nice.
The impression I have gained when I have watched it is that a lot of the people on it seem to be trying to, I'll term it, make themselves famous or well known. You know, let's say something dramatic and I'll be noticed. That's the impression I get from it. It's something I don't...
Do you not think they're natural, though? Do you not think that's what they actually believe? I mean, when they first did their opening appearances, they wouldn't have thought, here's my chance to make money.
No.
Here's my chance to be famous. Yeah. They were just telling it like they felt it.
That's right. I would accept that they're probably saying what they genuinely believe. But I think they see it also as an opportunity to get themselves on to Arsenal Fan TV, and I can show my face off here. I think there's what you say is right. You know, I'm sure they do believe what they say, but I think there's an element of trying to be famous as well.
It's interesting. The most famous Arsenal Fan TV video is the legendary Chris Hudson after the Aston Villa game, and I think it was the beginning of the 2015-16 season. Chris will only go on a couple of times a year because he's not interested in that. But, you know, he could be on every game and they'd love him, but he basically decides not to do it generally. Others, obviously, do people become addicted to fame, best team.
Yeah, of course they do. But I'll be honest with you, I've never seen Arsenal fan TV. I'm of the generation where I just watch Match of the Day and go to games, and that takes up enough Arsenal time for me. I'd like to do other things in my life as well. I just wouldn't have time to watch Arsenal fan TV, to be honest with you. People get addicted to anything. No fear of me getting addicted to Britvic 55, Kev.
Yes.
Other things, yeah. I mean, fame is definitely an addictive thing, I should think. I mean, it's something that when I was younger, I was in a band. I thought, when I was young, I want to be famous, you know. Now, actually, it's the last thing I really have on my mind. I even use pseudonyms. I don't want, you know, I'd rather create something that's interesting or good or of worth, and put the principle before the personality, so to speak. But of course, yeah, I mean, a lot of people are famous for being famous, aren't they? They don't actually do anything. I mean, they haven't actually worked on a craft or an art or anything, and they're just sort of famous for being famous. So.
It started in this country sort of in the early 21st century with Big Brother on Channel 4, where, you know, when you get like 12 people trapped in a... Well, in a prison, essentially, you know, for between 12 and 14 weeks, just being themselves, and just their odd catchphrase or quip or whatever becomes their face. And as a result of that, I've had programmes like Made in Chelsea, The Only Way is Essex, Geordie Shore, where people are just being themselves. And that's what Arsenal Fan TV's become. I mean, doing all the TV work, etc., I do for the Gooner. I've been on Arsenal Fan TV twice. The presenter on Arsenal Fan TV and me did a piece for Sky Sports Soccer Saturday. At the start of the season, actually, one of the many games we lost when we should have won. This was sort of September October time, and then we got on really well. And he said, "The next game, make sure you come and find me afterwards." And it was all I got there, and it was kind of like walking into a dressing room / studio, in the sense that you've got the presenter and the cameraman next to him, and he's there with his red microphone, and then you've got like the three regular cast members. My favourite fam. Guy,
Troops.
That's it, Troops, yeah. Troops is there already going on, and I was kind of like ushered to the front, which was kind of weird. And the look I got was like, who the hell are you taking my stage? And just presenter asked me a couple of questions, and I just gave a quip saying, you know, the only person to lose by two or more goals on his debut and costing over £10 million on both occasions is Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain. And I got a standing ovation from all of them and disappeared. But yeah, it was people being parodies of themselves almost.
I can understand, like, for a professional footballer, I don't know, Ozil or someone like that, right? I mean, they're really good at something, they've made a career out of it, and therefore they're famous, right?
But isn't that a reflection?
Arsenal fan TV is just like a load of fans.
Isn't that a reflection of
stuff, isn't it?
The modern era, in terms of people becoming famous without necessarily having...
being very good at anything. Yeah, well, no, it's like the X Factor. I mean, you've essentially got a kind of...
Exactly.
But mind you, look, you used to have Huey Green's Opportunity Knocks, right? And every now and again, someone would come on there and they would really be talented and they would make it.
Jim Doberson, know. Nick.
And what was her name?
God.
Bonnie Langford. Bonnie Langford.
That's really?
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't say she was that talented.
She became
a little girl and she hit it, you know, through that kind of thing. But it was slightly different. That was a competition. But now you've got X Factor. But then you get to this whole other level. At least they're turning up and they've learnt an instrument or something, or they're singing, right? Badly or not. But when it's just like Big Brother or a load of people on a reality show sitting on an island somewhere getting eaten by tarantulas or whatever they do, you know, and it's just... they're not really doing it. It's like what we did on our holidays, isn't it?
I'm going to put this to you, all right? Social media, in this day and age, actually has a huge amount of influence. And the very real possibility of influencing in terms of the PR world. So, for example, I'm well aware that the Arsenal Press Office follows very closely Twitter and Facebook and YouTube, Arsenal Fan TV, etc. And if something is, for good and bad, promoted in social media, sometimes the club will need to respond in a way that maybe 20 years ago they wouldn't. Can it be a force for good?
Yes, it can be. Like you, I've also heard from a source I trust that Arsenal do, the club does follow what's said on various social media sites. And I was hoping towards the end of last season that they would actually start thinking about how many people wanted Wenger's contract not to be renewed. And they completely ignored that, obviously. I think, you know, it was renewed because of the FA Cup final win. But I was hoping that the club would actually sit up and say, look, you know, the fans really are against Wenger these days. Maybe it's time to appoint somebody else. But they still chose to ignore the fan base. Yeah, because as I think is still the case, I think a huge majority of Arsenal fans now want to see the back of Wenger. But the club ignored that, or Stan Kroenke personally ignored it.
I wonder whether it makes so much difference, because, I mean, ultimately, yes, you've got, it's kind of an extra voice, but you always had, look, the North Bank, right? And if they didn't like Sammy Nelson, they let him know, right? Mm. Or if they didn't like, you know what I mean? So in the ground, you know, in a way, maybe that accounts for the silence now. Everyone's using their right thumb and tweeting away, and they're not singing and they're not shouting and they're not, you know, as much. But I think, you know, there is, I think it's pretty obvious, I mean, with regards to Wenger, that people aren't that happy, and I think the club knows that. I think everyone knows that anyway. I think one way or the other, via one osmosis or another, it will get through to people. I do think, though, that, I mean, there was a time, the original question, you know, back in the late 80s, for example, people might have gone home grumpy. I mean, I remember after, you know, drawing with Wimbledon and going and just thinking, oh, you know, effing and blinding on the way home, and then maybe in the pub later or to whoever I was with, and then that would kind of be the end of it, you know, talk to the greengrocer about it, whatever, right? But if you then have, say, 3,000 Twitter followers and you put out, you're suddenly talking to 3,000 people, you know, potentially. So yeah, I suppose it's different, but ultimately the message just finds another way of getting there, doesn't it? One way or the other, the bleeding obvious becomes the bleeding obvious.
Well, it does, but I'd argue the scale is different in this day and age. I mean, the other thing which I think is noticeable for any club at any time is physical attendance. Now, granted, people who don't turn up at Arsenal home matches have paid for those seats, but you can't ignore the fact you've got 25% of the ground empty. From people who've actually paid for their tickets and are still not interested in
going. Well, you've got to ask yourself, will next season those people bother buying it?
Well, yeah, I think that's the one thing the club are comfortable about.
Yeah, but how long will that wait list? I mean, how bad can it get before?
Well, that is the question.
Nobody around this table knows the exact length of the waiting list. But, I mean, I personally think that social media for the club acts kind of like this big brother, keeping an eye on what everyone's talking about, what everyone's worries are. I mean, suggestions like, I think there was a walk before, there was supposed to be a walk before the Everton game,
yes,
right outside the old East Stand, the entrance, but it didn't go ahead in the end. But the club was just keeping track of it was going to happen. Same as if they're keeping track of any supporters groups like BSM, AST, AISA, want to get together and, you know, do something. They just want to keep an eye on absolutely everything. I mean, from a marketing promotional point of view, like when it came to our old right winger, Theo Walcott, when he was going to sign
not
his...
Not politically.
No. when he was getting around to him potentially signing his new contract by a few years ago, I mean, you had that hashtag, signed that in. And the club grabbed hold of that, because then as soon as he signed the contract, you know, they're using the hashtag all over the place, and that makes them popular amongst social media users. I mean, it's a great marketing tool for them. They get an eye, keep an eye on it, on what everyone's whinging about and whatever. And not when it comes to revealing transfers now. I mean, they're revealed in a swanky way, rather than just an official press release on the club website.
One thing that's losing me as a football fan is the amount of PR, marketing, three kits, you know, all that stuff. It just, I mean, I'm old school, but it pisses me off, and I'm sure I'm not alone. you know, that when it all becomes about that, you know, and I'm standing at the greengrocer's talking about Arsenal, saying, oh, that's not going very well, is it, because we've lost. And then some woman pipes up, saying, no, my, you know, my what's-his-name works for the, you know, Arsenal, and we're doing awfully well because we made lots of money last year.
Arsenal are very...
go, fuck off.
Arsenal,
I mean,
are very grateful for your 40 years of customary, but the 15-year-olds, they've got another 50 years of customary in front of them ahead of. That's who they're focusing on.
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah.
You know.
Okay.
It's a different animal now, anyway. You know, from Highbury to now, it's just a totally different animal. So, but there you go.
Well, we're on the subject of arson. Last month there was a question I didn't ask from Jonathan Houseman. I'm going to ask it now. Are you hopeful that any new incomings have been identified by the new off-field appointments rather than Arsene Wenger? As I would not trust him with a penny of our cash, as the signings of Mustafi and Xhaka have proven. Now, in the January transfer window, we signed a young Greek centre-back. We did a swap deal which brought Mkhitaryan to the club, and we bought Aubameyang. Do you think these guys were identified by Arsene or the new well, the scout? Because in theory, the guy from Barcelona didn't start until the 1st of February, so it would have either been the scout or it would have been Arsene.
Isn't there some bloke from Dortmund as well?
That's the scout.
I'm fairly certain he would have been very, very influential in...
Well, two of them were former Dortmund players.
Yeah, exactly.
They played together as well.
Yeah. But regarding that guy's comment about the new players that haven't really worked, so Xhaka and who was the other
Mustafi.
One? Mustafi. I have to say, I think they've been Wengerized. And what I mean by that was, try and think of the last players that have definitely improved after joining Arsenal. People like Sanchez and Ozil were already world stars when they came to Arsenal. And are they any better now? I think it's highly debatable, and I would say they're probably about they were about the same level. The last players that I can think of who have definitely improved after joining Arsenal was Koscielny, who joined in 2011, Giroud, who joined in 2012, and Monreal, who joined in the January of 2013. There's a 5-year gap there, and I don't think a new player that's been signed has improved since Nacho Monreal. I would also...
Keep going.
I would also make the point that when you look at young players who have come into the side, like Brett Bellerin, who's already been discussed, and I'd also say Iwobi as well, I don't think they're as good as when they first came into the team.
They've been Wengerized.
I'd go as far as to say the last players who really improved under Wenger were Ray Parlour, Tony Adams. I wouldn't say he improved, but he got some longevity out of the Adams in the back four, didn't he, with the stretching and the new diet and everything. And there was seemed to be a kind of an upping of the game. But yes, you're right, the Wengerisation, if you look at Vermaelen, you know, I remember him arriving, scoring a blinding goal, and then he just went down and down and down. Kalashnikov, right? I can't say his name.
Kalashnikov.
Yeah, that's it. I call him Kalashnikov. Anyway, he looked brilliant when he arrived. He was brilliant. And now he's just got worse and worse.
Yes,
I mean, there's something. Wenger manages to get players to...
Yeah.
Don't shoot, whatever you do, and don't take a player on.
Yeah.
And, I mean, Bellerin as well, he just seems to be going within himself. Like, I mean, he's getting less and less of a player.
Yeah.
Yeah, Elneny, I mean, I remember he scored that goal against Barcelona. We went to the game away, sat in the rain, lost, but he scored the blinder against Barcelona. And he's just like, he will only pass backwards now.
Yeah,
I mean, that's all he does. He gets the ball and says, I'll play safe.
Yeah, I think they've all been Wengerized.
Yes, whatever you do, and don't take a risk.
Because Mustafi, when he first joined, he was really, really, really good.
Yeah.
I had great hopes for him.
Yeah.
And at Xhaka, you know, there is a player in there somewhere.
Mm.
But as I say, he's been Wengerized.
Do you know what I think it is? If you look at watching that 89 film and George Graham, And you look at great managers like Brian Clough and players like that, right? They'd crack the whip, right? You need shooting and all that, right? You get that sort of manager, and then you get managers like Guardiola and Wenger and people who understand, right? But the thing with Guardiola is he's still got that respect, and he's, you know, and Wenger, when he joined us, had a bit of that. He definitely had that, you know, and the first 10 years. I mean, you can look at it first 10 years, second 10 years, can't you?
Yeah.
And he just seems to have just gone too soft, I think. I just don't think he's got the authority in the dressing room anymore.
Yeah. Do you think he had authority in the first 10 years? Or was
it
the
fact... I think he had a huge amount of respect.
And he doesn't have that now?
It's like the respect you have for a grandfather.
I think he was brought in by David Dean the first time, and so he had the loudest voice on the board in his favour. I mean, even though, the story is that out of all the candidates for CEO, Wenger chose Gazidis, although he was probably second or third choice, certainly behind Peter Lowell.
Lowell turned it down.
Yeah.
Lowell would refuse to work under the conditions which he would have had to operate at Arsenal.
Which I'm guessing were second in command to the first team manager.
You can't have the CEO being told what to do by the manager.
Well, that was an interesting thing that came out when the announcement of the appointments of Lowell and Sven came into play. I remember the first quote that we got from Wenger was that our CEO has got nothing to do with the transfers. I have the final say in everything. I don't think there's necessarily any truth with regards to the amount of power or the roles of Sven and Raoul, but that was a proper two fingers up at Ivan, saying, you know, sod you. Because in answer to your question, with regards to the transfers that went through Christmas just gone, I don't think Wenger had final say or necessarily any say in all three of them. I mean, as soon as we brought Mavropanos, the centre-half, in, his first reaction to that was, well, he's going on loan to Werder Bremen for 6 months. He's got absolutely nothing to... Oh, he's turned up for training. He's quite good. Yeah, he can have number 27.
I have it on good authority he'd never heard of the player before he'd actually been signed.
Really?
And yet he made this quote about we know every player in Europe.
So I've forgotten what the original question was.
Well, we'll move on to another one anyway, because we are running out of time. Mike Francis, on a similar area, which we can briefly go into. Mike Francis, the founder of the Gooner, can't be with us this evening. He says, overall, how pleased were you with the January's transfer contract dealings? For what it's worth, I think we came out a bit better than I expected. Low expectations, perhaps. Also, what's the deal with Aubameyang? Every club in Europe were after him 2 years ago. So we signed these three players. Okay, we may see them memorised, we may not. Okay, what do you think of that month in terms of the change to the squad?
I think it's summed up Arsenal brilliantly in the sense that everyone's been saying throughout the course of this season that our problem is our midfield from a defensive point of view, and our back five or back four, depending which formation we play, are absolutely awful, and we need to improve that. So we leave it until 6 o'clock on the last deadline day, after quotes from Alan Pardew at West Brom come out saying, if I get a silly offer from Arsenal, there is no way it will be accepted whatsoever. So at 6 o'clock that night, we make a bid of £7.5 million for the captain of Northern Ireland, to which Alan Pardew doesn't pick up the phone. So essentially, we wait until the last out the window to essentially publicly admit we acknowledge that our full problem is our defence and we do need to improve it, and we fudge up that transfer. Well played, Arsene.
Yeah, but the point I'd make about the defence also is that I would say Wenger is incapable of making the team play in a system where we can have a good defence, if you like. You know, we don't have a dominant defensive midfielder anymore. You know, the four defenders, the normal four defenders, as individuals, are all good players. But it's the system that Wenger gets the team to operate in that makes us not defensively sound.
Yeah, it has to, like, I mean, if you look at those players, player for player, I always ask myself, if Guardiola or Pochettino were manager, right?
Yeah.
Sorry to bring up the Spurs manager, but let's be honest. If he was manager of Arsenal, we'd be watching a different team, wouldn't we?
If Pochettino was at Arsenal with exactly the same players as Arsenal currently have, we'd be a load of points better off.
I think there is a generation thing here as well. Look, Guardiola and Pochettino, right? They're young enough still, right? so that the players have some kind of, you know, these are 20-year-olds you're talking about, right? So they've got some kind of 20-somethings, and they want to have some kind of relationship with their manager whereby, you know, Wenger is, he's just, it's time to hang up the boots. Yeah. You know, it's like, you're all right, granddad. You know, I mean, I'm sure they're very respectful and very nice about it, but yeah, quietly then, round the back of the science block, whatever, you know what I mean? It's different,
right,
isn't it?
Yeah.
So it's old Mr. What's-his-name, you know what I mean?
That's right.
So I think you've got someone like Guardiola talking to you. You've got that enough in common with him to go, all right, you're the gaffer and I'm not messing with you. So I think that's,
I mean, people go on about the stability of having one manager for so long. I think you can be in post for too long.
Yeah, of course.
And I think that has happened over quite a few years with Wenger now. Yeah. You know, he's now, whether you call it going stale or him just being a has-been, but he is past his best.
With hindsight, Bernard,
yeah.
When should he have gone?
I think he should have gone in 2014, at the very, very latest, because they just won the FA Cup against Hull, wasn't it? And he could then have said, well, you know, I brought the first trophy to the club since they moved to the Emirates. And I think that would have been a perfect time for him to go. And I think he's been ruining his long-term reputation ever since.
David, when, with hindsight, do you think he should have gone?
Oh, crikey. The end of the 2011-12 season.
Basti?
I agree with Bernard, I think. Hull after Hull would have been good. That having been said, he's won two FA Cups since then, and the last one would have been a good time to give up as well.
Yeah.
Just any time the captain of Arsenal lifts an FA Cup, Wenger should now say, now's my chance to get out with a smile on everyone's face. You know,
go out on a high.
Yeah, I mean, having said that, he still now thinks he's going to win the Europa League. And possibly, like, if we were to win on Sunday and we were to win the Europa League, then it would definitely be time, Monsieur Wenger, to go on that nice, well-earned holiday. You deserve it. You have the money for it. Go and enjoy your life. Write the book. Come on.
Okay. For me, it was the end of the 2008-09 season, which was a complete disaster and demonstrated that he no longer had his mojo. Anyway, let's move on to we bought Aubameyang, so I'm going to squeeze in a question from Peter Squire about the attack. When Lacazette is fit again, will Wenger have to choose between him and Aubameyang up top, or can they play together in our strongest and best balanced starting 11? As we know, making tough choices isn't Arsenal's strong point. Would this be a two up front?
Definitely. Sooner the better.
Right.
I mean, that's one thing. I look at Liverpool, right? They've got three strikers out there. Goal, goal, goal. You know, look, for some reason, we've had, whether it's Giroud on his own or Lacazette, he always plays one player on his own, standing there with two defenders around him.
Yeah.
You know, and remember the days of Ian Wright and Alan Smith playing off each other? You had a righty also off Bergkamp. You had, you know, you got two strikers there, you know, what, very different types of strikers too. And with Aubameyang and Lacazette's more kind of like, you know, takes his chance, walks around a bit like Malcolm McDonald, it reminds me of, sort of the fact he doesn't look like he's doing an awful lot of running around. But given a strike partner, he needs some confidence as well. Yeah, look, two words, Toshack Keegan, right? I mean, that's what I grew up watching. Match of the Day. Sorry, it's not Arsenal, it's Liverpool, but you watch that Match of the Day, Toshack Keegan, 2-0, that was it, right? For me, to have a strike partner, you're going to get more goals. And I don't see why Wenger thinks he's got this amazing midfield that's just going to, so Ozil's going to supply, you know, that one player up front.
Yeah.
And we end up with Monreal scoring all our goals.
I'd have no problem in reverting to two up front at all. You know, I've been following Arsenal for a very long time now, and it's only in the relatively recent past that we've gone to one forward. Unfortunately, you know, going back to my expression, I think Lacazette is being Wengerized. You know, he doesn't look as good a player now as he did when he first joined us. So, you know, I find it hard to get excited by all these transfer rumours and transfer speculation these days, because I think we could sign Lionel Messi and
mess him up.
Okay, well,
spoiler alert, he won't play two up front. I think it kind of got summed up in the Spurs game, in the sense that Wenger will play 4-2-3-1, or he'll play 3-4-2-1. Those are the only two formations he'll play. Let me finish. Aubameyang and Lacazette, different heights, same player. Aubameyang's never scored a goal outside the penalty area in his professional career. He's a goal snatcher, whereas Lacazette is a 5'6" goal snatcher. He's going to start off with Aubameyang now. I mean, I feel a bit sorry for Lacazette, in the sense that in the signings we've taken in January, we've created what Lacazette had at Lyon last year, which is Nabil Fekir feeding him over and over again to finish off from 6 yards. Borussia Dortmund had that for 3 or 4 years, with Mkhitaryan feeding Aubameyang. So Wenger's essentially said, didn't quite work with you, so I'm going to go to plan B within the same season. So, sorry, Lacazette's taken over from Giroud as our first choice French forward substitute.
Okay. Let's talk about a player that departed in January. Mr. Lancaster has tweeted, this was from last month actually, and I didn't ask it. So he says, Sanchez will no doubt get booed next season. Did I ask this, discuss player getting booed in January?
Not sure.
Sanchez will no doubt get booed next season when he plays for us, brackets modern day football. However, should we be booing him? The bigger picture is, just like Cesc, Nasri, RVP, the board can't meet top player ambitions and we end up selling to rivals. What does this say about Arsenal? Well, I don't know about the board can't meet top player ambitions unless they're quashing the wages. It's actually the club and everything that entails not matching the ambitions of players who want to move on. So let's start off with booing players. I mean,
oh, for Pete's sake, to be completely honest. I mean, last two times Chelsea had been at our place, every time we went near the ball, Fabregas was booed. I don't get that. What, because the young Catalunian has gone back to Catalunya when his football, the football club that brought him to England were selling everyone around him, and we were going below his level of skill and brilliance, and he went to Barcelona and won the European Cup. Same with Van Persie, who I thought gave a great statement, saying, I had a very long meeting today with Ivan Gazidis and Arsene Wenger, talking about extending my contract. I said the club needs to sign this, that and the other and get the team going this way. They disagreed, and I don't want to be a part of that team anymore. How can you blame Van Persie for that?
Well, it's funny though, because there's certain players, it's just a given, right? It has been like that over the years. I remember Stapleton going to Man United.
But that was money.
So, but the thing is, look, whatever the reasons are, some players will get booed, some won't. Like, you know, the Ox and Walcott will come back and everyone will like them, right?
Well, I don't know. The Ox got booed.
Well, did he get booed?
A smattering of boo. I don't
know. No, he got booed.
Did he get properly booed? All right, okay. Well, you know.
Children at the Arsenal.
Panto season.
But it is Panto. Well, that's the thing. It is Panto. That's the whole thing. I mean, look, it's as Kev always tells me, and I sit there freaking out because Arsenal aren't doing what I want them to do, right? Which is most of the time, and I'm pulling my hair out. He says, oh, for God's sake, calm down, Bass. It's entertainment, right? Chill out, okay? And it is, ultimately, look, you've got to have a laugh with it. And some play, you know, it's all part of it. You know, booing Sanchez when he comes back. And I'll be honest with you, I was going off Sanchez anyway. I think, funnily enough, I did hear somewhere that, as not to be, if someone can confirm it, that Walcott actually tweeted that, you know, or said something about Sanchez that he'd become toxic, and it doesn't sound like Walcott saying it to me.
That would have been a tweet.
Someone was probably tweeting a tweet or a fake news tweet, but someone said, you know, but I could imagine that, you know, Sanchez is kind of, I didn't like the way he used to throw his arms up in the air, go like that, you know, that kind of waving his arms up every time a decision didn't go his way or a player didn't do something he wanted to. I don't know how great he is in the dressing room, you know, he's a bit, you know, Barcelona got rid of him, didn't they?
Because they signed Suarez.
Yes, he's got ability. He's an amazing player, but
he gives the ball away an awful lot.
And he does that. Yeah, of course he does. Yeah. So I mean, I look forward to sort of watching him. It's quite weird watching him in a Man United kit and sort of hoping that, you know, just every time Man U lose, yeah. you can rub your hands together, you know. hopefully, maybe he is toxic, and hopefully he's got not the opposite of a rabbit's foot, and he can just bring them down. Which
toxic
would be nice.
Were players like Adebayor and Nasri, who were clearly all about the money. Whereas, I mean, Sanchez yeah. was just like, you know, I'm one of the 10 best players in the world, and with all due respect, I'm surrounded by crap. Or, no, I'm not surrounded by crap, I'm surrounded by good players, who unfortunately following crap instructions from their line manager. Exactly. I'm 29 years old, I've only got 5 years left at the top. Okay, I'm getting £500,000 a week. It's a sheer coincidence, obviously. But.
I could see him and Mourinho having problems, though, somehow. I could see the egos getting, you know, the thing about Mourinho, you know, it'd be interesting to see how that one pans out anyway. But I'm not bothered Sanchez went, to be honest with you.
Let's move to the goalkeeping department. Simon Rose, occasional panellists, has tweeted, should Ospina play for the rest of the season, given that he can save penalties and Cech can't?
No, in my view. Because I actually think Ospina would be a better goalkeeper in another country, somewhere where Ospina has an alarming weakness when it comes to dealing with high crosses into the box, and that's something that happens an awful lot in England. I think if he moved to a Spanish club where he wouldn't have to deal with all these high balls into the box all the time, I think it would benefit Ospina greatly, and I think he'd look a far better goalkeeper than he does at Arsenal. I know Cech doesn't save penalties, but he is still a good shot stopper, as he showed against Tottenham. Okay, the kicker, his kicking was a disaster at Swansea, but he's far more competent with dealing with crosses into the box than David Ospina is. So I think Cech should still be the goalkeeper until the end of the season, and then maybe look for a new keeper, because he is getting on himself. Yeah. But
who did we sign Ospina from?
French team, Nice, I think.
Okay. There's been speculation about either Oblak from Atletico Madrid.
That's Raul's dream boy, isn't it? Apparently.
Or Timo Horn from Cologne, who's Mislintat's dream boy. David, you're the keeping experts. Could you just briefly tell us if either of these is the quality required?
I'm a keen reader of 442, and they're doing a top 100 in each of the positions in the world at the moment. And Jan Oblak came number one and beat Gigi Buffon, who, interestingly, is being replaced by some young Polish kid called Szczesny or something. Never heard of him. Not good enough for Arsenal, though. Cheers, Arsenal. Well, he did smoke a cigarette once, so there we are. Jan Oblak, he seems great. I mean, for the start, he's the goalkeeper at Atletico Madrid, the team that we're hoping that we don't have to play two legs against in the Europa League this season. He's tall, he's mighty. Imagine Matt Macy, but built like a man. and has got 10 years of international experience. That's Jan Oblak.
How old is he?
Mid-20s.
Right. Who did he play for?
Atletico Madrid.
Okay.
Based on the limited things I've seen on the Premier League on Sky Sports with the delectable Terry Gibson or Scott Minto presenting, he seems to be great. I mean, the best thing about signing a goalkeeper from a good side like that is, similar as we found out with Jens Lehmann, is that the goalkeeper has absolutely nothing to do for 89 and a half minutes, and then the last minute one's going in the top corner and a fingertip sends it over. I mean, everyone remembers Jens doing that at Old Trafford in that game.
Old Spunky Seaman did that a few times.
Exactly.
But sometimes those two horrible, you'll always have to live with those two horrible mm-hmm. moments. What was it? Naeem and Ronaldo.
But yeah, I take off that.
Ronaldinho.
With regards to Timo Horn, as Liverpool have found out, I mean, everyone thinks Bundesliga is the greatest league in Europe at the moment, purely because of Bayern Munich and a little bit of Borussia Dortmund every now and then. And Horn's not Manuel Neuer. It's a bit of a gamble with him. And Loris Karius looked absolutely brilliant on paper in terms of what Liverpool were signing from Germany, and it turns out he's as bad as Simon Mignolet. So maybe
a second choice. Yeah, yes. A reserve.
Would you say that it's probably Cech's last season, though?
If it's not...
well, I mean, what's his contract?
End of next season, I believe.
Okay.
He could go into rock and roll. He plays drums, doesn't he?
Which is in pretty much entertainment from the players. Right. So now let's look at a question from Jonathan Houseman. Another one. Does securing the second highest sponsorship deal in England equal the manager staying in for a longer period than we all might like?
To me,
that sounds like shoehorning in a Wenger question. Let's skirt over that. Do we think 200 million for 5 years shirt sponsorship from 2019 to 2024 is going to look like a good deal in 2 years' time?
I'm not convinced, no, because the thing is... the current deal, or this new deal, expires at the end of the 2023-24
season. No. Oh, it's a new one?
Yes.
Yes.
£40 million a year, considering how football inflation goes up, which isn't, you know, it's not the same as general inflation. But I think £40 million quid per season is going to look like a pittance in 2024.
Mm. Okay. Any other views, gentlemen?
I think it's actually going to make us the third in the country rather than the second, because it's Manchester United, obviously, and City in terms of money laundering for Etihad.
Yes.
So I think we're third behind those three. Yeah. I don't think it's a bad deal, but ultimately the £40 million they give us every year is probably the transfer fee, not the wages or signing on fee of one reserve player.
Yeah.
You know, but that makes
it's weird that I've flown with lots and lots and lots of airlines. Right, I was an onboard courier for 10 years. I've never flown with Emirates.
Oh, I have.
Have you?
Yeah.
What are they like as an airline?
It's beyond first class.
Well, that's probably why I haven't flown with them, because I can't afford them.
Their prices are cheap because they're so heavily subsidised.
Oh.
So you get cheap prices and good service because they've no interest in making any profit.
Wow.
And as an Arsenal member, when booking through the Emirates website, you do the user code ARS10, you get £10 off your £900 fee. So
£10?
Absolutely.
Come on.
I phoned Switzerland. I'm living off the interest.
I was getting all excited. I'm at 10% or something. That's £10.
Oh, no, dear. But for me, the shirt sponsorship deal is too long.
Yes.
One little point I'd like to make. This three kit sponsorship and whoever it is we do it with, right? I mean, I find it that really one thing as a fan, and some people go, who cares what they wear, right? But if we're playing, funnily enough, when we play Tottenham away, we always wear our home kit, right? But when we play Swansea away, which is pretty much the same as a Tottenham kit, we don't. If I could be the dictator of all things Arsenal, I would just say, right, Arsenal wear that red and white home kit on every occasion they can, unless they physically can't because it clashes. And I don't care about the sponsorship. Puma, just lump it and like it, because that's how we are, right? And unfortunately, I'm not the dictator of all things Arsenal, but I think wearing these three different kits, right, having two away kits, it just doesn't do us any favours. It doesn't. The whole vibe. Look, if you turn up at Swansea in an Arsenal kit, things might just turn a little bit against them, and they think, "Oh fuck, we're playing Arsenal, not some bunch of geezers in blue or whatever."
I've got mixed news, bestie.
Go on.
Sunday, the cup final.
Oh, don't.
Now, Arsenal will be wearing the home strip.
Good.
So will City. However, there is a colour clash on the shorts.
That got reversed a few hours ago.
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah. We're back on white.
Oh,
yeah.
My God.
That shouldn't make a difference, should it? I mean, you know, if you've got a big red and a blue top, the shorts shouldn't matter.
Obviously, sense has been seen.
So are we going to be wearing red shorts?
We were going to be wearing red shorts originally.
Ooh.
And then they realised the TV audience worldwide was going to be big. Oh, sorry, no.
Recently, Arsenal did wear red
West
shorts.
Brom away.
West Brom. So yeah. What? So hang on a minute. So why is that?
Because
why?
It would have looked ridiculous.
I can remember. I'm sure I can remember wearing red shorts in the early 70s.
Yeah, there was
late
a period.
60s.
Late 60s.
But the thing is, right, okay, here's what I don't get. Against West Brom, we have to wear red shorts. Against City in the final, we don't. Right, it's one or the other. You can't sort of go, oh, well, because it's a final, it would look ridiculous.
Well, different, so rules different organisations, the Premier League and the Football League.
Ah, different organisations.
Indeed. OK, let's move on to Josh Kroenke. Renting.
Did he send a question?
Rent boy.
No, he is renting a place in London for 3 months. And he's going to be looking over the Arsenal operation in every department with a
fine. Rent boy Kroenke.
Where's he living? Archway?
Fine. Or? I've no idea where he's staying.
I bet it's not Archway.
I'm guessing it'll be somewhere like Park Lane. That's just a guess.
I'll keep an eye out in Hampstead. What's he look like?
No. It'll be Park Lane. I'm
Park
sure.
Lane, all right.
Is Stan handing over the decisions about Arsenal to his son, or does he just not trust the information he's getting from Ivan Gazidis? What do we make of Josh's arrival to do this work?
Well, he's run one of the sporting organisations for KSE, the basketball team. Can't remember what
the Nuggets.
Yes, the Nuggets.
Denver Nuggets.
And the first thing he did, if you do the research, have a look at this up on the website, was basically the Nuggets had the same coach for like 20 or 30 years, was falling short, and Josh Kroenke sacked him.
Wow.
Yeah. With like so many tweets and apologies for doing this, that and the other. And then from there, the Nuggets kind of like won their conference the next year and everything. And it was
by coach, you mean actual manager in footballing terms?
Yeah.
So Josh could, if Josh comes sailing in and sacks Wenger... He could be a big hit round here.
He could transform the reputation of the family overnight.
Yeah. Having said that, that's a level of power that Josh Kroenke had. I mean, I think he looks after their Major League Soccer franchise at the moment as chairman or the American equivalent vice president or SVP or whatever, same as he does with Nuggets. Whereas ultimately, it's his father who looks after Arsenal. Long-term passing it over, maybe. I mean, we don't know the nature of Stan's health, you know, but I mean, ultimately, I mean, he can invest or, you know, same as the Tampa Bay Buccaneers guys at Manchester United, you know, weigh a lot of his debt onto Arsenal.
He can't.
Sorry?
Only if Usmanov sells out.
Yes. Oh, yeah. It takes 100%.
So, yeah, what's happening with Usmanov then?
Basically, Usmanov is sticking around on
the principle. He offered a takeover, didn't he? Usmanov did £1 billion.
Yeah, I'm not sure that actually genuinely.
It was a shot across the barrels, really.
Yes, it was. Basically, it's personal, and Usmanov will never sell to Kroenke, and Usmanov will probably only sell to a third party on the understanding that they don't sell to Kroenke.
Well, that's a good thing, isn't it?
Yeah. It is a good thing.
It is a good thing
because that stops Arsenal going down the Manchester United model, where the club is used to leverage.
Because isn't that where it all went wrong with Lady Bracewell Smith and Fisman and everything? It was like Fisman fell out with
David Dean,
didn't he? Yes. And it was like there was all this not over my dead body stuff
going on, wasn't it?
Yeah, the legacy. Unfortunate pun with Danny Vitsman, but
all right, well, let's move on to Sunday, as we've only got about, we'll go over a little bit, we haven't got long left. I'll just get the final question in because I've done very well this month getting everybody in. So it's one from Mr. Lancaster. He says, if we win the cup on Sunday, should we consider it an end of an ending or a start of a new beginning? I will answer that, Mr. Lancaster. We've seen too many false dawns, so we're going to get beaten anyway, so what the hell. Let's briefly move on to the final.
Any predictions?
Well, yes, let's do some predictions.
City will score.
Right.
Yeah, I wonder what odds you get on that.
Let me say this. We've been in 7 League Cup finals. We've lost 5 of them.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask for very brief memories here. And the first two, I'm going to leave you two guys out, Basti and David, because only Bernard can remember these. Give me your memories. 1968 against Leeds.
Yeah.
And 1969 against Swindon.
68... I remember, I think their goal was scored by Terry Cooper, the full-back, if my memory serves. I can't promise I'm right, but that's my memory of it.
You were there?
Yes, I was there. I was there for both the Leeds and Swindon finals. I wasn't expecting us to... I was a young, very young kid at the time, but I wasn't expecting us to beat Leeds, because they were red hot at the time. But Swindon were in the old third division back then, and I was expecting us big time to win. And I can't say it scarred me for life, but I, because Swindon beat us that day, I still dislike Swindon Town to this very day. I don't follow their results, but if I'm, I've got Talksport on the radio, and they mention, oh, Swindon have just lost or been relegated, I think, good.
Do you cheer?
It's 49 years ago now. Do you have any memories of the pitch that day?
Yes, it was dreadful. They just had some sort of horse show, I think it was, on it.
Yes.
But I remember Don Rogers scoring twice, Ian Muir giving a goal away with a poor mistake, and Bobby Gould scoring our goal. But the pitch was dreadful. And
was there a horse show on the day before?
Yeah, that's right.
Right, for the next two, I'm going to leave you go to you, Bestie.
What were the next two? Remind me.
1987 Liverpool.
Oh, I was in Germany at my dad's house listening to it on the radio, upstairs, desperately trying to get a reception. And just about getting some kind of reception. It was on World Service or on something. And I remember just being over the moon when Charlie Nicholas got a couple of goals. But I wasn't there. Now, I was... How old was I? 87? I'd have been... not very old.
No. 88 Luton?
Oh, I was there for that. Oh, my old classmate scored the winning goal. A schoolmate.
Good God.
Steen.
Mark Steen.
Yeah, Mark Steen. He went to school at Hampstead Comprehensive School, and I remember going up there. I was all excited. I thought Luton were definitely going to beat Luton. You know, that whole feeling. And I had this. They had those like 50s style rock and roll jackets, Arsenal jackets. Do you remember? It was like red with white sleeves, but it was sort of like a leather sleeves. Yeah, for fans. Yeah, and I remember I got and proudly bought it at the Gunners shop. And I remember going up there and I remember going home and I think I probably cried on the pillow that night. It was pathetic.
We were 2-1 up.
It was
Mr. Penalty.
Playing right back, Mr. Penalty.
Oh, it was a painful
and then,
day.
There was a missed kick by Gus Caesar. I think it was a 2-2.
You know, it's funny, I don't remember hardly anything about the game. I just remember, the final whistle standing. I was really high up at Wembley standing and it was just... just horrible, horrible. It was a long walk home.
87 was better, as I did actually.
Yeah, exactly.
I can recall the game better than listening on the radio. It was a mixture of a youth and experience in that Arsenal team, and it was a bloody good team as well. And it all came together on the day, and it was fantastic to beat a team that were dominant at that time, against the odds.
When Ian Rush scored first, Liverpool never lost a game.
And yeah, until that,
right.
That final.
Yeah.
David, I'm going to go to you now for the next couple. 1993 Sheffield Wednesday.
Oh, lovely.
Reserve left-back being made central midfielder, scores his first and only goal for Arsenal, and then the pissed captain says thank you by breaking his arm. Oh, Steve Morrow. Collected his winner's medal during the FA Cup final replay.
I was there for that, yeah.
Oh, bloody hell. John Harkes, the American, opens the score.
It did, they scored first,
for Sheffield Wednesday. Yeah. Who equalised? Kevin Campbell.
Paul Merson took the free kick... Was it Campbell? Was it Wright? I can't remember.
Kevin Campbell, because there was talk about not playing Wright because he got so in the cup final because he got so nervous in the League Cup final. All at Wembley.
Right.
It was like dropping.
So Campbell got the equaliser from the Merson cross. Okay.
Was that the cup double? Was that where we won the?
Yes,
cup?
It was 93.
Yeah.
That was the great final when the alcoholic captain dropped the goal scoring winner onto his arm, broke it, and Merson celebrated everything by drinking pints after pints that after pints.
Yeah.
Right, next up for you, 2007 Chelsea.
2007. Oh, young Theo Walcott
in Cardiff
scored his first goal after 12 minutes. You know,
was that early?
First 20 minutes, I'm pretty certain, and then Drogba made Philip Senderos cry by beating him with a header.
We were out muscled.
Oh yeah. It was men versus boys,
wasn't it? Wenger picked a team
exactly
that I mean, what was he doing? He just didn't care about winning that trophy, did he?
Oh, you say that. He wanted to prove a point in the sense that I've played my childish cup team throughout this tournament.
Yeah.
And if they play to the best of their abilities, they could beat the Harlem Globetrotters or anyone. And they'll beat the... Oh, shit.
Well, in fairness...
Well, he isn't going to do that this
in
year,
fairness, the first half hour of that game, we had Chelsea on the ropes. Mm. It just could not finish them off. They didn't know what was hitting them because they just hadn't played these players.
Well, finishing off's not been sort of Wenger's forte of the last 10 years.
Right, I'm going to ask for a volunteer for the final one. Birmingham 2011.
Oh, Femi Martins in the pissing rain.
Yeah. Well, my only memory is Koscielny on his knees at the end and that little bastard smacking him on the back of the head like really hard.
Ferguson, I think it was.
Yeah, he didn't tap him. He actually cracked him one on the back of the head. Mm. And Koscielny was so shell-shocked, he kind of didn't even do anything. He just sort of took it.
That was after him and Wojciech were doing...
Yeah,
your ball?
Right.
No, your ball. No, your... Yeah. Oh, fucking over. Ferguson. Oh, no. In the last minute.
Yeah.
Right, Sunday. Man City. Just beaten by Wigan last night. It's a cup final. Arsenal beat Man City at Wembley in a one-off game last season. Needed extra time, possibly a bit fortunate. Arsenal have demonstrated in this competition, in the semi-finals, a resilience that has not been familiar for most of this season. Will we see it again at Wembley? Will it be enough? Who is going to play central midfield to stop Man City running the show?
Chaka.
Was Chaka dropped for Osterhans away?
No.
You don't think he was dropped?
No, I don't think so. I think it was half a cup team, half a let's get enough goals in the first leg so any Nketiah can get a hat-trick.
He was rested, wasn't he?
You think he was rested?
Yeah, yeah.
Because he was so poor against Spurs.
Against anyone.
That I thought Wenger actually played what was his strongest team. He wasn't going to play Koscielny because Koscielny is now playing... selected games that he has to play, but really he's injured.
What is our strongest team?
Well, in theory, if everyone's fit, then you know you're going to have basically the back four we're going to have on Sunday.
Yeah.
Who
is that midfield? Who's the best?
Well, that's
midfield?
At the moment. It could well. Let's say Chaka has been dropped. It's two of depending on fitness and.
Well, Ramsey's not going to be fit.
In that case, it's Wilshere and Elneny.
Okay.
That's a weird mixture.
You don't think Maitland-Niles will retain his place?
I hope not, because whilst a very promising looking kid, it's kid, which is the operative word.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. I was just thinking, like, you know, I really, Wilshere is being so, he's so promising at the moment. I mean, he's the only one who seems to bother, right?
Mm.
But, I mean, Elneny, you know, it just breaks my heart if I think of Vieira and Petit, you know.
he's got to play Elneny as the only real defensive type of midfielder we have.
Yeah,
he's got to play on that.
I just can't see whatever we put out there.
You're not optimistic.
I'm not optimistic at all. But then again, I wasn't going up to Palmer in the final of the Cup Winners' Cup, and we won that. So you know, it doesn't matter what we think on the day. Who knows? But if you ask me, I'm prepared. I'm prepared for defeat.
Yeah, City are very, very firm favourites.
Yeah, I mean, it's like they are properly
perhaps
good.
Perhaps even more so after losing to Wigan.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they want to put things...
Well, where the pressure's off, you know. Yeah. There's that whole thing.
To give us a little bit of hope there, they'll probably play their cup keeper, Claudio Bravo. Their left back, they don't really have one, so they're going to have to put a centre back out there, or one of their more attacking players. So they have got areas where they're not as good as they might be.
No.
And cup finals, you know...
As we saw last year.
In a one-off game, anything can happen. Mm. But, as I said, City are very firm favourites.
So who's he going to play then? So we're saying Wilshere and Elneny.
Yeah.
Well, OK, I'll give you. Let's say, first of all, we assume it's back four.
He won't play three.
Right, okay. So the back four is basically Bellerin, Mustafi, Koscielny, Monreal. Okay? Centre forward's going to be Aubameyang. All right? Yeah. So then you've got seven players for five positions. Elneny, Xhaka, Maitland-Niles, Wilshere, Ozil, Welbeck and Iwobi. So, I mean, my guess is he'll play Ozil as one of the wide attackers, Welbeck or Iwobi. He'll play Wilshire, and behind him maybe Elneny and Xhaka.
It's a bit disappointing because neither really Iwobi or Welbeck have really impressed that much. Once again, Wenger-fied, because Iwobi, I was really excited about Iwobi when he first started coming up, and then he seems to have sort of just...
Yeah.
Wenger-fied. Welbeck as well. God, talk about Wengerfication.
Yeah, yeah. No, when he first joined, I thought he looked...
He scored against Man United in the FA Cup. It was like, God, here we go, you know, brilliant. And then, what happened, you know.
Well, we'll reflect on this on the next podcast, but we have to finish now as we are well over time.
What are the scores, George Dawes?
I think City will win 3-0.
David?
Penalties, and I... Well, it's penalties, anyone could win it.
Bestie?
I don't even want to say what I think it'll be. I'm more along the lines of 3-0. I'm even thinking possibly 4.
Right, okay. Well, just time for a quick plug for the current issue of the Gooner, which can be bought outside the ground at Thursday evening's match with Ostersunds. There'll be a new edition out for the Premier League fixture against Man City a week later. Next month we'll see us go into overdrive on the campaign to keep the Gooner going next season, and many thanks to those who have already committed by sending their £30 via cheque, online bank transfer, or through the Gooner website store page. We've still got some way to go to reach our target of 1,000 subscribers, but are optimistic at this stage. As usual, a reminder that you can contact us regarding anything to do with the podcast via Twitter at Gooner Podcast. Email goonerpodcast@gmail.com. Many thanks for the questions and topics submitted for today. With that, it is goodbye from David.
Good evening.
Bernard.
Goodbye.
And Mustafa.
Goodbye.
We'll be back with the next edition in March. Until then, this is your host, Kevin Witcher, saying goodbye and thanks for listening.
La-di-da-di-da, la-di-da-di-dee, all good things and jolly good company. Way!